The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, welcome everybody to the show. We're going to spend this hour focusing on the fallout from the President's State of the Union address just a couple of nights ago. And joining us for our first segment, we've got an all-star panel full of bright people from Patton Boggs that work in the policy sphere every day. We've got Norma Crayham, Josh Green, Vince Ferlicci, and Stephen Gavin, all of whom are familiar to our listeners here. We're going to talk, first we're going to start with you, Norma. Tell us a little bit about your sense of where the President hit or miss on the State of the Union the other night.
Thanks, Kevin, and it's great to be back on this morning. Look, I think the President did what he needed to do in his speech. He focused on a number of core issues that his administration cares a lot about, and certainly the Congress, jobs, the economy, the nature and the needs of our troops. And I think he made a decision to ratchet back that maybe the big vision issues and focus on a number of core things that he thinks that he can get accomplished with his administration and the Congress. He only picked one issue that I can see that really was designed to make a point about where he is versus maybe the House Republicans, and that was, of course, health care. And that, you know, you can agree or disagree if he should have spent that much time on it, but I think he tried to balance issues out along the way.
Let me turn to you, Stephen, and give us a perspective as a Republican of how the President did the other night.
Well, Kevin, I'm in Europe, and maybe because I watched it live, I have less, at 3 in the morning, I have a less enthusiastic view of it. And indeed, I think he's even coming to the point where it reminds me that perhaps we were best off when the State of the Union address was simply sent up to the Hill and read to the House and Senate. I think the President, sure, I think Norma has a very valid point in terms of certainly how the President is to be perceived by his supporters. But a big component of the President's agenda was economic growth and trade. And you already have yesterday Reid pulling out the rug from under him on the trade issues by saying he won't support fast track. And I think that with the departure of Senator Baucus, I think we're going to have much less chance for any kind of tax overhaul. So I think from an economic growth standpoint, certainly from the big issues like trade and taxes, I don't see us going anywhere. And too much theater, we can use a few less Lenny Skutnik moments in the State of the Union.
Oh, Lenny Skutnik. He's going all the way back to 1981 or 83 there. Vince, let me throw it to you because Stephen referenced Senator Reid, and you're one of our resident Senate experts. Give us a sense of if you were one of those vulnerable Democrats up for re-election in 2014 in a seat in the Senate, how did you react to the speech, and what does it mean for the decisions you have to make in the coming year? Vince, you with us?
Yeah, I had a little difficulty there. Sorry. I think if I was a Senate Democrat running right now, I would be happy with the speech. But look, the candidates running right now basically need the president's approval rating in their respective states to be as high as possible. It's not very high in a lot of these states right now that are going to decide the outcome or the control of the Senate. Therefore, I mean, I think that the president's focus on action, executive actions, et cetera, showing action in a Congress and a town that's been branded recently among the American public of a town of inaction should raise his number in some of these states a little bit and therefore help some of these candidates. So I think pretty favorably.
Josh, let me turn to you. One of the areas you focus a lot of attention on is clean energy. The president spent some time in the speech talking about American energy strategy and what it means for our economic development. What was your sense of that and what it means for that sector of the economy?
Well, thanks, Kevin. So a lot of what we heard from the president are things that are not necessarily new. It certainly helps the industry, helps the sector to be discussed in a State of the Union, that's for sure. And the president covered a broad swath of the energy economy, from obviously renewables, cleaner sources of energy or less carbon intensive forms of energy, as well as natural gas on the fossil side and many other things. So I think the energy sector writ large wasn't necessarily surprised at all with what the president had to say. We've been following a lot of things in the executive branch and the regulatory level. I do think there were a couple of new things that popped up related to natural gas vehicles, et cetera, as one specific thing. But generally speaking, it's kind of the status quo of where we are. But once again, the president reaffirming his commitment towards transitioning the American economy to a more sustainable, reliable forms of energy. Again, nothing new, but it's always good to hear the president talk about the sector and give people things to think about.
Norma, we've actually got an email question that's come in. It's from Tammy in Philadelphia, who's asking, the president talked a little bit about the minimum wage and raising that. What impact do you think that that'll have on the economy, and does it have a chance of becoming law?
You know, that is obviously a great question, and we have been debating the issues of raising the minimum wage for quite some time. I think there is a disconnect maybe between the parties as to what that does. I mean, the minimum wage, I don't really believe, is a living wage, and that's the challenge we have in this economy. We have seen corporations rebounding since the downturn in the economy. Some are doing great, some are not. And there are many on the Hill who will say raising the minimum wage means that they will cut jobs. I don't personally believe that to be the case. I think we're going to have a hard time getting that through the Congress, though.
Very good. Stephen, let me throw it to you. I asked Vince a little bit about how Senate Democrats up in 2014 might react to the speech. If you're one of the Republican strategists in those key election states in 2014, what did you hear in that speech that made you happy headed into election season or that worried you?
I think that the president's health care numbers are going to continue to be very bad, and I think that is, from an electoral issue, that's a good thing for the party. I talked a little earlier about the trade and tax issues. I think that whatever the president said, I don't think there's going to be much happening there. I think we're starting to go into a period where we will see some contradictory signs in the economy already in the last couple of sessions. The Dow is down because people are going to be increasingly pulling on its stocks. That's going to be as a result of relatively higher interest rates. I think that the electoral landscape still looks good for Republicans in the fall, and I just saw a poll pop up, Rasmussen saying that Cassidy is ahead 44-40 on Mary Landrieu. So I think if I'm a Republican strategist, I'm thinking we still have a relatively good chance of taking the Senate, and I'm pretty sure we're going to hold the House.
Vince, let me turn back to you. So the president talked about his frustration that where Congress had gridlock, he is going to look for the opportunity to use executive orders to accomplish his objectives. Talk to us a little bit about how far that power might extend and where you think it might most logically be used this year.
Well, I think he outlined a lot of those things in the speech, particularly on your question to Norma a minute ago on the executive order that he's going to sign here shortly to raise the minimum wage to $10.10 for federal contractors and federal contracts. And I think they're going to look for other executive orders in other places and then roll them out strategically throughout the year. You know, and I think the pros and cons of that are the pros that he can just, you know, quickly control the message and move it out on a pace that makes sense politically. The cons are is that these executive orders can be wiped away by the next president. I mean, and therefore could only last for a short while and wouldn't really leave a legacy for him as opposed to going to Congress. Although, I would say overall, I think this whole executive order focus that the media has had and others have had on the State of the Unions, I think it's been a little bit kabuki theater, in my opinion. I think that what the White House was trying to do here was, instead of doing what they traditionally do, was just to tell Congress, I want you to pass issues 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yeah, it really didn't focus that much on that and let the focus be on these executive orders, because it's a little bit like dealing with a, you know, if you're a parent, you know, sometimes if you want your son or daughter to do something, the best thing to do is to not tell them to do it. And when you tell them to do it, then they won't. And I think Congress right now is so dysfunctional, particularly in the House of Representatives, that I think what the president did by focusing on the executive orders was to maybe give the House an opportunity to do some things because they're not being told, and therefore they don't have to reject the president. So therefore I think, and this is reflected in our firm State of the Union analysis on our website, I think very well, I think, you know, we're going to see potentially a lot more action over the next 6 to 9 months on a lot of issues, maybe even immigration reform that we wouldn't have seen. I think this speech allows that a little bit to happen.
Yeah, Josh, let me close with you. We've got about 2 minutes left, and Vince did talk about the firm State of the Union analysis, which anyone who's listening can find at pattenboggs.com. I think it is an excellent outline of the optimism that we collectively seem to have for what might be achieved. So outside of some of the things mentioned today, are there other big-ticket items or even small-ball items, Josh, that you think Congress might be willing to undertake in the first half of this year?
Well, I would say, you know, if one defines small ball as things that are not controversial and perhaps don't increase the deficit, maybe those options right there come down a peg or two. But there's certainly some things, you know, in our space that I'm heavily involved with energy efficiency, a broad bipartisan bill that's endorsed by, you know, green groups like the NRDC as well as the U.S. Chamber of Commerce that could be done. I think there are some miscellaneous bills related to streamlining government and certain government programs that can be done. Again, I think there needs to, however, be a more spirit of cooperation. It's tough always to do in an election year. We're starting to see a slew of additional retirements that were announced today in my space. You know, a very big announcement in Henry Waxman, longtime crusader on energy and environment issues, has announced his retirement from Congress. So with weighing that and some fatigue that's going on with its farm bill and other things that are coming down the pike, there are certainly some opportunities to work together. Just the question ultimately becomes, is there enough goodwill and energy left to do that? And unfortunately, it's yet to be seen.
Very good. Well, we're going to stop it there. We've got the rest of the hour devoted to individual topics inside the State of the Union address, immigration, education, and healthcare reform. But if you want more information on the State of the Union analysis that the firm has put out, I encourage you to go to www.pattenboggs.com. We're going to be back in just a moment to talk about immigration reform here on Capital Thinking.
Have you friended us on Facebook yet? Why not? Just go to facebook.com/World Talk Radio or search for the keywords World Talk Radio. Once you're a part of our Facebook network, you'll receive daily messages about what's happening with our shows, this week's featured guests, and new happenings at the World Talk Radio Network. And you can add your voice to the always active discussions on our timeline. Just go to facebook.com/World Talk Radio or search for World Talk Radio.
Stay up to date on the latest news out of Washington affecting your business. Check out Patton Boggs' new Capital Thinking blog at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. Let one of the world's best legal and political intelligence networks keep you in the loop on the policy developments that matter to you most. Access the network today at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. That's capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back, everyone. Well, we are going to continue our walk through the issues that were raised in the State of the Union address earlier this week, and we turn to the thorny issue of immigration reform. Joining us for this discussion, Sam Mudrick, who is an associate at the Patton Boggs Washington, D.C. office, where he focuses a great deal of his practice on strategic counseling for multinational and domestic corporations looking at immigration law here in the United States. So, Sam, welcome back to the show, and maybe give us a little bit of a reminder of what the president said about immigration reform in the State of the Union address and maybe what he left unsaid.
Sure. Good to be here, Kevin. Yeah, it was interesting. The immigration got one paragraph, if you pull it out of the speech, the written speech. It was a lot less, I think, than some people were expecting, and some were disappointed by it, but I think it was a strategic move, and I think it was probably a smart move. He basically just took a very broad stance. He said, there is bipartisan support. There are a lot of people in the United States behind it. This is something we need to do. He stressed that it's a good economic move, that it would grow jobs. CBO last year said that it would grow. Earlier, it said about $900 billion over the next couple of decades. So he stressed that. But basically, then he just stepped back and he said, you know, I invite my colleagues to move on it. He didn't make this a partisan issue. He didn't add any unwanted pressure. And so I think it was a move basically that gave some support, some breathing room to the leadership in the House. You know, it was somewhat passive, and I think it was smart. There's a lot of pressure in the House and on Boehner and Cantor from both sides. You've got people pushing real hard for it, and you've got people who are opposed to it. So I think the president's somewhat tempered response was a good one.
Sam, it's an interesting situation, right? I mean, in many respects, the things the president cares most about are things that he might want to strategically talk the least about in the hopes that Republicans will take them up as opposed to block them simply because he cares. As we have this conversation, House Republicans are at a hotel in suburban Maryland having their annual policy retreat where Speaker Boehner is supposed to be unveiling his immigration reform principles for the House of Representatives to take up a piecemeal approach to reform. So maybe start by giving us a sense of what it is you think the parties agree on, because the Boehner's unveiling his principles, and the Senate has actually passed a comprehensive bill. So where's the overlap?
Yeah, there is a bit of overlap. I think the important thing about Boehner's principles, he said they're not going to be language for a bill. This isn't going to be details. He's going to release some guidelines so that he can get the conversation going on in his party. The Senate bill is a good starting point. But the Republicans in the House, like you said, have said very adamantly they're not going to do a big comprehensive bill and that they disagree with a bit of the Senate bill. However, there is a bit of overlap. First of all, border security. It's not a difficult vote for any member of Congress to say they want to strengthen the border. Both parties are behind that. And actually in the House, the bill that was brought in committee was a bipartisan bill. So that was probably the biggest overlap there. There's a lot of demand for high-skilled visas to expand certain sectors and to especially improve visa availability for investors and for people trying to start businesses in the U.S. And frankly, just last year, labor and business, they did come to a big sort of historic understanding and compromise, and they've both been showing that they do want reform. The other big thing that there's agreement on is the DREAM Act, called the Kids Act in the House, although the two versions of that same act are a little different. Last year, Cantor made it very public that he now supports that kind of move to make sure that kids who are brought here undocumented or illegally when they were children, you know, no fault of their own, should have a way to get a green card or get legal status here. So there are certainly differences, and that's what slowed things down and killed it last year, but I think there are some good building blocks to move forward.
So one of the big bones of contention is the so-called path to citizenship. And you've got Republicans all over the map about whether or not offering a path to citizenship is amnesty, or whether or not the status quo is de facto amnesty, or whether or not offering a path to citizenship actually will encourage more illegal immigration in the future. Talk to us about some of the knotty obstacles that they face in solving that policy dilemma.
Well, you hit most of them. First of all, I think there's a big portion of the Republican constituency who see it as just plain and simple breaking the law. You're rewarding people who came here illegally, and that you shouldn't do that. They should have to leave or go through the normal system. There's another really big thing is the fear of a pull for future illegal immigration. The mantra that you keep hearing is, look at 1986 when Reagan signed his big immigration reform bill, and at the time there were only 3 million undocumented folks. And now they're saying there's 11 to 12, and so they say, look, this didn't work. The counter to that is border security is much more effective now. Internal I-9 and E-Verify processes for employers has increased. And just technology in general, documentation tracking systems makes it a lot harder to make this sort of a pull for future illegal immigrants. And then you have the issue also of people waiting in line. You know, they don't want to reward people who are here illegally when there are several, you know, millions of people also waiting to immigrate through families or business that are still in line to do so. So I think those are the big issues. But I think it's also important to note that the line issue, I believe, is dealt with pretty well in the Senate bill. The legalization and eventual citizenship that they proposed would take years. And the bill also had significant measures to speed up the processing of those already in line. So you really wouldn't have much of an overlap there if the Senate bill were passed. Now, the Senate bill is not going to get passed. And the big issue right now is whether there will be a path to citizenship. And I believe it's softened a bit on the Democrat side. There's some recent polls of Hispanics in the United States that said a good chunk of them, and actually a small majority, said that citizenship isn't the most important thing for them, that it's legalization, being able to travel, being able to work legally. So I think that softened a bit early on in the Senate when they were discussing their bill. That was sort of one of the big sticking points, and they said, no, it's going to citizenship or nothing. And now in the House, it's looking like there's going to be a little more compromise. Who knows what it'll end up as? But the House certainly is not going to pass a big comprehensive bill with citizenship included. It's going to be piecemeal bills, and probably more likely than not, it will not include citizenship, but some sort of pathway to legalization.
So, Sam, when I sit at home on the weekends watching television with my wife, she likes to do one of two things. She's either watching home improvement shows on a couple of those channels, or she's flipping back and forth between the Rachel Maddows and the Sean Hannitys of the world and getting angry at both sides of the political fence. And I think one of the things – I'm just trying to watch ESPN, by the way, at all that.
Good weekend for you coming up then.
Yeah, exactly. One of the things that frustrates her is that the broad difference in the message about what immigration might do for economic growth, because you just hear such shrilly different things from each end of the political spectrum. So talk to us about what immigration might actually do, pro and con, for economic growth.
Sure. There are holes in our economy, and they've been filled in certain fields by illegal or undocumented immigrants, depending on what word you want to use. You've got the big ones are agriculture. Our agriculture system is propped up right now with undocumented workers. And to fix that and to keep that system running, reform will need to focus on making a quicker, a more efficient and cheaper system to bring in workers that are needed that can then leave when they're not. That's the sticking point. Will they leave? There are also holes in the tech industry. A lot of tech companies would like to grow and hire more tech workers. But frankly, there's a quota right now, for example, on the most popular tech visas, the H-1B, and there's a quota, 65,000. It's the general quota. There's some other available. But that's just not enough for some of the people in the tech industry. And finally, it's really tough to get a visa if you're an entrepreneur that doesn't have a ton of money. So those are some of the holes, some of the problems that I think this reform will address. And it will help the economy in those ways. Finally, you have legalization aspect, which is the most controversial, but if you take 11 to 12 million people out of the shadows and allow them to more confidently buy a home or open a savings account, or frankly travel home to El Salvador or to China or wherever they're from, and then to pay their full taxes, you've got a boost as well. Like I said earlier, the CBO, before the Senate bill passed, and just after, said you're probably going to get around $800 to $900 billion of increase in the economy over the next 2 to 3 decades. So there is real money there, and I think the bill would be a boon to the economy.
Very good. Well, I got about 2 minutes left, so give me your prediction of where we go in the next 6 months in the House and ultimately in a conference on immigration reform. Does this get done, and what happens?
I would love to sit in on that conference. It will be interesting. Like I said, you're going to get piecemeal out of the House, and we'll see how those get conferenced and what stays in, what goes out, if they clump together and place the Senate bill. But I was on a panel down at University of Virginia where I went to law school recently about immigration law, and this was a couple months ago, and I said, you know what, I don't think anything's going to happen until after the election. And just in the last couple months, the momentum's picked up enough that we're feeling a little more confident that those House bills are going to start passing before then, that this is something that the leadership has seen is not going to hurt them necessarily in the elections, but might actually help them if they can get some bills passed. But you never know. People thought there was some momentum coming out of the Senate last year. So I think there's a sort of a maybe a 50-50 of whether or not you're going to get some things introduced before the election, you know, late spring, before the summer recess, or whether it just gets too messy and members up for re-election don't want their names associated with this reform. Because you got a lot of House Republicans who are in contentious races right now, and a lot of their constituents don't like immigration reform or want to make sure that it's not a compromised immigration reform. So it could get messier as we get closer to the election, maybe pushed back past the election.
Sam, hit everybody with your email address if they've got questions.
Yeah, I'm Sam. My name's Sam Mudrick, and I'm at S-M-U-D-R-I-C-K at patentbogs.com.
Very good. We're going to be back in just a minute to talk about what the President said in the State of the Union address on education, both K-12 and higher education, with one of our guests from the corporate world. You're listening to Capital Thinking.
Find out which guests are being featured this week. Read our network press releases and read the blog posts from your favorite hosts. Go to iradioblog.com today, powered by the Voice America Talk Radio Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola.
Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Markaba.
From Denver to
Hello.
Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes
Niko.
Business transactions
Gracias.
The world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Stay up to date on the latest news out of Washington affecting your business. Check out Patton Boggs' new Capital Thinking blog at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. Let one of the world's best legal and political intelligence networks keep you in the loop on the policy developments that matter to you most. Access the network today at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. That's capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than 4 decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back. Well, we're continuing our tour of the State of the Union analysis, and we're going to turn our attention to education. Joining us is Jeff Livingston, the Senior Vice President of Education Policy for McGraw-Hill Education. Jeff has had a distinguished career in a variety of fields. After graduating with 2 degrees from a small place called Harvard, Jeff has been a successful entrepreneur with specialties in instructional technology and marketing to urban school systems. He has then spent several years in investment banking and trading of financial derivatives, and has held a climbing the ladder of a variety of corporations involved in the higher education and K-12 technology space. So, Jeff, welcome to your maiden voyage here on Capital Thinking, and I want to start by asking you to tell us a little bit about what you think the president's speech did positively and maybe omitted on education in general.
Well, thank you for having me, Kevin. It's great to be with you on this very important show of yours. You know, as always, I listen carefully to the State of the Union, and I think in terms of quantity on education, it was about average, but I have to admit to feeling that it was a bit pessimistic with respect to content. For example, I noted immediately that there was no mention at all of the ESEA or HEA, the Higher Education Act, or the Elementary and Secondary Education Act reauthorizations. Now, a part of me wanted to see this as sort of political jujitsu. If I don't mention it, maybe they'll actually reauthorize them. But the rest of me saw it as throwing in the towel that anything significant could happen on these two foundational bills that are way overdue for reauthorization. So I was saddened by that as someone who cares a lot about education policy.
Well, yeah, let's take that apart. I know yesterday you did a really innovative thing. You had a Twitter conversation with Politico doing the same sort of analysis of the State of the Union, and one of the things that struck me from that transcript, which you just repeated here, was basically the president seemed to be throwing the towel in on ESEA and higher ed reauthorization. I guess my question is, unlike immigration reform, what we just talked about, where I think the president did exactly what you said. He failed to talk a lot about immigration reform because he wants Republicans to take up the baton. Here on higher ed and K-12, I want to ask you, do you think maybe he omitted it because he has spent so much time using his executive powers that he has largely reshaped the environment to something he's much more comfortable with?
I suspect it's a bit of the other way around, Kevin. I think that he believes that he is unlikely to get any meaningful progress and compromise on these bills through the current Congress, even less so in an election year. And as a result of that, he and his administration have leveraged the amazing power of the presidency to do some things anyway. And so I think he really has been trying to advance his agenda as much as possible without the Congress, and he admitted as much last evening. For example, if you think about things like Race to the Top, right? Now, no matter what you think about any particular contest, the notion of achieving a brand new near consensus on education policy without reauthorizing ESEA via these competitions, for the political scientist in me, I think that's just brilliant, right? It really has been a policy initiative that has gotten a lot more done than one might have expected to get done to inspire a new consensus, especially during the middle of a major recession. Now, portions of it haven't been implemented as well as anybody would have wanted.
Right.
But it reminds you in our system how powerful the presidency and the executive branch really are, because they can get things done even when Congress decides to take a pass on some of these issues.
Now, I know one of the things that had to get you jumping out of your seat at home was the president's discussion of ConnectEd and some of the corporate partnerships involved there. Walk our audience through what he said there and what you hope it might mean for that program.
Well, the president very correctly restated that the expansion of broadband to more students is vital to the modernization of our educational system going forward. I mean, companies like mine already produce nothing only in print. Everything we do has digital components. And what the ConnectEd initiative and even the E-rate modernization process are about is providing access to students for whom school is going to be their primary means of access to the internet. I mean, for example, Kevin, right now the typical American school has the same bandwidth that I have at my house and you have at your house, except that we don't have 300 people at our houses trying to use it at the same time for instructional purposes.
Well, maybe on Super Bowl Sunday we might.
Well, that may be then, but the point is that schools need more and better bandwidth, and through the ConnectEd process, they're getting it. And McGraw-Hill Education and other companies in our industry have been very much involved in trying to shape how this will happen. Because it's not whether these technologies are going to be applied to education, it's for whom are they going to be applied and in what context. This is about making sure that the great American public school system, which has been a leveling influence from a socioeconomic standpoint since its beginning, continues to be so in the digital age. And the work that's being done by the FCC and by the administration around ConnectEd and the E-rate modernization, I think will be their real legacy with respect to education policy.
All right, I got an email question from Jen in Atlanta who wants to know a little bit more about how the digital revolution is reshaping the college experience.
Okay. So to Jen in Atlanta, think about this. When I was in college, I had to figure out before an exam how to go through my notes, what portions of the textbook I needed to review, take any clues that the professor chose to give me about what might actually be on the exam, do my very best, and go in and take the exam. Today, 2 million American students right this moment are using just one product from McGraw-Hill, our LearnSmart product, that allows them to have a customized study plan, for example. We know what you know based upon your assessments that we have given you and some metadata about how sure you are about what you know. And we know the content because we've been in the content business in all of the foundational subjects in the traditional college curriculum forever. So we can say, you, Kevin, need to be studying this right now, and you should study it 2 hours each week between now and your exam to maximize your chances. That kind of personalized advice and education is only possible because of the revolution in digital technology and because colleges are more likely to have broadband access and students are more likely to have the devices that can take advantage of it. What we really want to do is to make that revolution that's happening on college campuses right now available to the K-12 system, and that's why we are so supportive of the ConnectEd initiative and the E-rate modernization. But it's a great question.
Well, I got one other question for you that's a big picture one, and that is Common Core. Talk to folks a little bit about what Common Core is and isn't, and maybe the challenges which seem to be breaking out at a lot of state levels about how to implement.
Now, I will admit that I was one of those people who, like your wife, Patty, was flipping back and forth between the political extremes on television looking for the reaction to the president's speech. And even during the speech, I found myself saying, don't say Common Core, don't say Common Core, don't say Common Core. because the rhetoric around the politics of it has gotten so nasty and so vicious that it would have hurt the Common Core movement if the president had said something about it.
Radioactive. Now,
exactly. So what Common Core is it is an agreement among states from their governors and their chief state school officers to produce a common set of standards that are higher, deeper, more globally relevant, and specifically tied to college and career readiness, that these states all agreed to come together and to support in a collective kind of way. What it is not is a national curriculum being imposed upon the states by the Obama administration. And if he had said the words Common Core, then his enemies would have leaked Common Core to him in ways that are not helpful. In the United States, states and local governments decide what their curriculums are going to be. And we think that's a good thing. We think competition among school districts and competition among states make a lot of sense. I personally want more states to have higher, fewer, globally relevant standards so that students really are preparing for 21st century globalized economies. And whether or not they're called Common Core, what matters is that they're higher and they're better. For example, I know that you live in Virginia, which has never been a part of the Common Core, but right. The Virginia standards, their new standards are higher, better, globally relevant, and they don't call it Common Core. That is the point. It's not what you call it and whether it's that particular system. It's really acknowledging to students that the world in which they into which they will graduate is actually quite different from the one that you and I graduated into, and we need to prepare them for that world as opposed to preparing them for the world of two or three decades ago.
So, Jeff, you're sitting at McGraw-Hill Global Command Center right there above Penn Station in New York City. I want you to whip out your crystal ball and give me, I got about 2.5 minutes left here, a sense of a best-case scenario for education policy in 2014 at the federal level and your worst-case scenario.
Okay. So I think the best realistic case scenario is a little bit of compromise around higher education that involves slightly more accountability on behalf of institutions that receive federal student loans and greater support for different kinds of models for students getting through college. Plus, the E-rate initiative at the FCC goes through and begins to have a real impact. The worst case scenario is that nothing meaningful changes, and the Common Core becomes a political football that distracts the entire system, state and federal, from the fact that we are at a significant moment in the history of our country and our economy that our system of education can help us to get through. So hopefully we can make a little bit of compromise in Congress and a lot of progress around ConnectEd and E-rate. And pessimistically, it would be nothing but talk where each side gets into their respective camp and doesn't budge an inch. So I'm not pessimistic enough to believe that the latter is going to happen, and I'm doing everything I can to make sure that the former comes about on behalf of American students.
Very nice. Well, Jeff, I know you have one of the more provocative education Twitter feeds for folks to follow. So for people interested, why don't you give them their Twitter handle so they can follow you?
Certainly. Please join me on Twitter at livingjeff, LivingJeff. And let's continue the conversation. I'm very interested to know what your listeners have to say about education policy and our goals for affecting it.
Very good. All right. Well, we'll be back in just a minute. If you like your radio show, you can keep your radio show because we're going to talk about Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act implementation right after this commercial break here on Capital Thinking.
Mm-hmm. Your favorite Voice America Talk Radio Network shows and hosts are in your car, outdoors, and wherever you need them to be.
Listen anywhere.
Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back. We wrap up our analysis of the State of the Union speech given by President Obama this week by bringing on Karen Thiel, a partner here at Patton Boggs in Washington, D.C., to continue our ongoing conversation with her about implementation challenges for the Affordable Care Act. So, Karen, very interesting to note, the president didn't spend too much of his time on health care in that address Tuesday night, but he did sort of edge into apology land for trying to explain away the rollout challenges we faced for the exchanges. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, he mainly gave a very upbeat report on Obamacare and highlighted the early accomplishments, as he's kept saying, kids staying on their plan, parents' health insurance plans until they're 26, no pre-existing conditions, no lifetime caps on coverage, and then, of course, introduced a mom who'd gotten coverage with a pre-existing condition. So it was fairly upbeat. He didn't make a direct apology. I think he'd done enough of that in the paper, and I think the administration strategy now is to say we've got a new contractor in place with Accenture. We've put former Microsoft executive Ken DelBene in charge of fixing the rest of what's going on with healthcare.gov. There still are issues with that. Some of the insurance companies are nervous about some of the back-end functionality of the system, and there's been issues with calculating the subsidies. But I think he was pretty upbeat. He also said that there have been over 40 attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and actually his count's a little off. As of Tuesday, there were 49 attempts. But then he challenged Republicans, if you have another idea, put forth the details, and we'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah, well, so I thought there were some numbers that might be a little bit funny in the speech. The president says 9 million people have enrolled in health insurance plans since the exchanges opened. Is that correct? Is that a little bit fishy?
Well, it would make you think that 9 million people have enrolled in private insurance plans through the state or federal exchanges. Actually, when you look at the breakout of the numbers, and Kaiser Health Network did a real nice job of this yesterday, what you see is 3 million people have signed up for private insurance plans through either the federal exchange or the individual 14 state exchanges. That's all. 6.3 million people have been determined eligible for Medicaid as they've tried to go onto the exchanges. And this is in the first 3 months of the 6-month open enrollment period. And the operative word here is eligible. These people, their information is still going to be sent to the state Medicaid programs. If you're qualify under traditional Medicaid, your application will be processed like that. And then in half the states that have expanded Medicaid, if your income it goes up to 138% of the federal poverty line, which is about a little bit under $27,000 a year for a family of three, then uninsured adults may be eligible for the Medicaid expansion. But that doesn't mean 6.3 million people have insurance. And even with the 3 million people, they still have to pay for it. So is it 3 million that have signed up or 3 million that have signed up and paid their first monthly premium amount?
Well, very good. The president has long sort of made the statement that there's no legitimate alternative being proposed by the political opposition. But this week, I think a couple senators seem to take the wind out of the sails of that charge. Talk to us a little bit about what three Republican senators have put out there.
Yeah, and these are three important Republican senators. It's Senator Burr from North Carolina, Senator Coburn from Oklahoma, a physician with longstanding interests in health care, and Senator Hatch from Utah, who has for many, many years been a prominent force in health care policy in Congress. We haven't seen a bill yet, but they have put out the most specific repeal and replace language we've seen on the Republican side since the Affordable Care Act was passed in late 2009 and enacted in 2010. This would be a bill that would repeal the Affordable Care Act. There would be no more exchanges at the federal or the state level. People would be allowed to keep their existing plans. They would rescind the taxes that were the pay-fors for the Affordable Care Act. These were taxes on medical devices, on pharmaceuticals, on insurers, on the plans themselves, and instead would provide, instead of subsidies for those up to 400% of the federal poverty line as exists now, they would allow tax credits to individuals, individuals earning up to 300% of the federal poverty line and small businesses with under 100 employees. So it would be a tax credit methodology rather than a direct subsidy. There would be right now there's unlimited ability to exclude from your income the amount of dollars that your employer spends on your health care. There would be no more unlimited coverage for that. They would set caps on the payments to the states for state Medicaid programs. No pre-existing conditions, anyone who is uninsured the first time they signed up would be able to get onto a plan with a pre-existing condition. And if you had a plan and changed employers or changed plans, you'd be able to continue that plan with your pre-existing condition. So some of the real fundamentals of the Affordable Care Act are made very, very different here. Not sure that this bill as a bill package would ever make it through the Democratic-controlled Senate, or would have, certainly President Obama would veto it. But in the meantime, we have the midterm elections looming, and there's a real concern, particularly people who are running for re-election in the Senate, about wanting to be on the record as making some modest improvements to the Affordable Care Act. So you may see a couple of bills coming up for vote. Senators Durbin and Schumer have been liaisoning between the Obama administration and Senate Majority Leader Reid to kind of take the temperature of the members, particularly vulnerable Democrats in the Senate, and look at things that might get a vote but not undermine the entire Affordable Care Act, things like extending the open enrollment period another 2 months. or allowing people to keep their canceled plans for up to 2 years, or making some more things qualify for a hardship exemption from the individual mandate, or New Hampshire, for example, has a bill up right now that would, instead of allowing plans to have these very narrow provider networks where you may not have your existing doc in your network, Senator Coburn was on record this week as saying his own oncologist was no longer in his the plan he bought from the federal exchange. So to make any willing provider be eligible for a plan in a particular state. So you may see some of that.
Very good. Karen, I got about 1 minute left. Anything else to close with we need to know about Affordable Care Act implementation this week?
We don't know. Because there are no pre-existing conditions or no health data, you can't be rated on health. We don't know who's applying. All we know is demographically about 24% are young adults, 18 to 34, and 33% are that 55 to 64 category. So we won't know until actually claims start going through the exchanges. Who's in the exchanges? Are they people with chronic health conditions? Are they relatively healthy young adults that are cheaper to insure? There's a lot we don't yet know.
Very good. Well, that's going to do it for this week's Capital Thinking. Go Broncos in the Super Bowl. We'll be back next week with more.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.